Hi, I'm Amy Goodman. Stay tuned now for Tell Somebody with Tom Clammer.
And I knew about the lies coming from the White House, from the State Department under Alexander Haig, from the CIA under William Casey and Bob Gates, and of course from the Department of Defense under Caspar Weinberger.
Today on Tell Somebody, former State Department and CIA analyst and author Mel Goodman talks about Robert White, former ambassador to El Salvador, and about much more. Stand by for Tell Somebody. Hello, and welcome to Tell Somebody for January 7th, 2016, www.tellsomebody.us, on Twitter, at Tell Somebody Now, and like the Facebook page, facebook.com/tellsomebodynow. This is your host, Tom Clammer. This week, we have the third show in something of a trilogy. 2 weeks ago, Kansas Cityans Alice Kitchen and Carol Colburn gave us a report on their participation in a delegation to El Salvador on the 35th anniversary of the murder of four church women raped and murdered by U.S.-supported Salvadoran military. Last week, we heard from Claire White, daughter of Robert White, U.S. Ambassador to El Salvador at the time of the 1980 murders, who also was part of the recent delegation. If you missed these two shows, you can find links to the audio at tellsomebody.us. This week, we hear from Mel Goodman, who was with the CIA at the time of these murders, and some years later came to be a close friend and colleague of the former ambassador. Give a listen now to a conversation with Mel Goodman recorded on Monday. I'm on the phone now with Mel Goodman. He is an adjunct professor at Johns Hopkins University and is a senior fellow at the Center for International Policy in Washington, D.C. His most recent book is National Insecurity, The Cost of American Militarism, and his forthcoming book is The Path to Dissent, A Whistleblower at the CIA, both published by City Lights in San Francisco. Mel Goodman, welcome back to Tell Somebody.
Thank you, Tom. It's good to be with you again.
We had Claire White on the show last week talking about her late father, the former ambassador to El Salvador, Robert White, and she called you one of her father's dearest friends, trusted colleagues, and a great hero. How did you first get to know Robert White?
Well, first of all, let me say I'm honored that Claire White referred to me that way and could say that that's how her father looked at me, because he was certainly a hero to me. I learned about Bob White when I was at the CIA, because I was head of the Office of Soviet Foreign Policy, and I was reading a lot of the sensitive cables that came in from the field, particularly in El Salvador. These would be cables from the ambassador, Robert White, and also there were clandestine reports from the CIA. So long before I met Bob, I was reading his cables. And the disturbing thing about the disconnect between what Bob White was reporting from El Salvador and what the CIA was reporting from El Salvador dealt with the fact that the CIA was providing a great amount of clandestine support to the right wing, to the military, to the secret police, to the Interior Ministry in El Salvador. And they were supporting the very people who were involved in a lot of the terrible crimes that were committed in El Salvador. And this is what Ambassador White was dedicated to stopping. In fact, not long after he got to El Salvador, he was responsible for demanding that the CIA bring back the station chief who was sending politicized reporting back to Washington and send a new station chief down to El Salvador. But of course, the crucial event, as your audience knows well, and from the interview you did earlier with Claire White, which I listened to today on the podcast, which was a wonderful interview, was the rape and murder of the four church women who were well known to Bob White. And I think several of them, or at least two of them, had had dinner at Bob White's house the night before they were kidnapped, raped, and murdered. What I knew, and I'm not sure Bob White knew this at the time, even though we discussed it later, is that the CIA knew who was responsible for those killings. In fact, the CIA supported the right-wing political leader, Roberto d'Aubuisson, who is, to me, a pathological killer, who had orchestrated the execution of the Archbishop Romero and was involved in the planning for the killing of the church women. So I was in the very difficult position of knowing what the CIA was claiming and knowing it to be false, and what Ambassador White was describing and knowing it to be accurate. I had a chance to discuss this before the Senate Intelligence Committee in 1991 when I testified against the confirmation of Robert Gates as CIA director, because Bob Gates at this time was the deputy director for intelligence at the CIA and was involved in covering up a lot of the reporting that came from El Salvador, that came from Bob White. So this was a very difficult time, obviously, in what was happening in El Salvador, but it was personally difficult for me because I knew what the truth was in this case, and Bob White, of course, was responsible for the truth, and I knew about the lies coming from the White House, from the State Department under Alexander Haig, from the CIA under William Casey and Bob Gates, and, of course, from the Department of Defense under Caspar Weinberger. And I think what needs to be understood is the tremendous support that the CIA was providing clandestinely to these right-wing movements throughout South America and Central America. So a lot of the instability, a lot of the violence really has to be placed at the doorstep of the Central Intelligence Agency and American foreign policy, particularly under the Reagan administration. And I realize to many people that Ronald Reagan is a hero in terms of his management and stewardship of the presidency of the United States. But to those of us who know the details of Reagan's foreign policy and know the horrors of what was taking place in South America and Central America, he was clearly no hero. Mm-hmm. I didn't meet Bob personally until a decade later, and that's after that testimony that I referred to before the Senate Intelligence Committee, when I received a call from Bob White. I had never talked to him before. I knew his work. I was surprised to get the call. I was teaching at the National War College at the time. I was professor of international relations because I had resigned from the CIA because of the politicization of intelligence that was led by Casey and Gates at the CIA. And Bob wanted to know, in hearing my testimony, would I be interested in coming to the Center for International Policy as a senior fellow to work with their group on reforming the intelligence community. And, of course, I was greatly interested in that. So somewhere in the mid-90s, I think, by the time I went over there, because I was still on the faculty of the National War College, I worked with Bob White. We traveled together, made a documentary film together on immigration from Central America and the responsibility of the CIA and American foreign policy for instability in Central America, which led to the great amount of immigration into the United States from Central America. And we became very close. Things that I wrote, I had Bob look at. He was working on his memoir before he died, and I read several chapters of that memoir, and I just hope, as Claire White mentioned in your interview with her, that that book can be finally published. It's a very important work because Bob was such an unusual individual, and I think his message needs to be heard, that there are these rare individuals, such as Bob, in the federal bureaucracy and the national security community, who are trying to get things right, who are not falling for the propaganda of one administration or another, and are trying to improve human rights situations all over the world and who were opposed to violence and particularly American support for militarism as part of its foreign policy. So this is a very important work. So from 1994, 95 until Bob died just last year, we became extremely close.
How rare is it for someone in a similar position to Robert White to be that forthright? I mean, I didn't know much about this before talking to Claire and, you know, after being introduced to her by these two Kansas City friends who went there a month or so ago. But, you know, I saw a, I don't know, 5-minute video by the New York Times that seemed to be a pretty good history of sketch of the murder of the church woman and forward from there with related issues, and told of Al Haig ordering Bob White to cover up, you know, make El Salvador look good like they're investigating this aggressively or something like that. And he just says, no. How often do you see something like that when
well,
somebody...
Well, in my federal career, my government career, which spans 42 years, United States Army, the Central Intelligence Agency, the Department of State, and Department of Defense, I would not need all the fingers on one hand to provide examples of people who have the kind of courage that Bob White had. Most people in any institution, whether it's the government or outside of the government, I find tend to be incredibly cowardly or at least weak, or maybe we should call them passive. It's very unusual to find someone such as Bob, who's willing to let it all out there in defending what he thought was the truth or what was the right position. We had a couple examples of this during the Vietnam War, when a couple Foreign Service officers resigned from key positions. I think this happened in the 1990s. One or two Foreign Service officers resigned over policy in the Balkans when President Clinton was very slow to respond to the slaughter of the Muslims in Serbia and Croatia. But for Bob, who was an ambassador, this is very unusual. Most people do, and I guess to bring it home in its most vivid terms, I would look at the career of someone such as General Colin Powell. Colin Powell, in 2002, was opposed to the war against Iraq. Colin Powell tried to convince President Bush that war was not the answer. And he should have resigned when it was clear by September, October of 2002 that we were going to invade. But instead, not only did he not resign, but it was Colin Powell who went to the United Nations in February of 2003, only weeks before the invasion, to give the 28 false allegations about Iraq and weapons of mass destruction. That's typical. It's typical for bureaucrats at any level to want to go along. Who know that if they take a principled stand, the bureaucracy will just find someone else to do their bidding, and that person would be removed from a position of authority. So what Bob did was extremely rare, and he took on a Secretary of State who had, of course, this important military career, Alexander Haig, I'm talking about, knowing that this was not going to go down well at the State Department, particularly given the Reagan administration's move toward the right from the very day that they came in. And one thing that needs to be understood that would supplement some of what Claire White said in her interview was you have to remember that when Reagan came into office in 1981, he brought with him a group of neoconservatives, of right-wingers, of troglodytes, as it were. Alexander Haig at State, Caspar Weinberger at Defense, William Casey and Robert Gates at the CIA, who were taking on a policy of militarism that they wanted to promote around the world. And I saw it vividly at CIA because you had Bill Casey ordering the clandestine operatives to mount all sorts of covert actions in countries around the world, and ordering people like Bill Casey and Caspar Weinberger at the Pentagon to step up maneuvers and exercises against the Soviet Union. So when there was a war scare in the Soviet Union in 1983, which was a very serious event that very few people know about, it was because the CIA and the Pentagon were conducting very extensive maneuvers and exercises that were violating Soviet territorial sovereignty, invading Soviet waters, Soviet airspace, and finally you had a Soviet leadership that believed that the United States was going to go to war against the Soviet Union. And it took the efforts of several of us to finally convince CIA Director Casey that this war scare was genuine and dangerous, and Casey finally took that message to President Reagan. But by then, people such as Ambassador White were gone from the government. They were forced to resign. He was offered some minor position in the State Department, and Bob White turned it down. He wouldn't be bought off in that fashion. And he ended up as the president of the Center for International Policy. And when he called me in the 1990s, he was the president of CIP. And it was a great moment for me to go over to CIP to meet Bob and finally to work with him on these important issues.
I want to come back to his work there and your relationship there. Anything more you can tell us about that? But backing up just a minute, I think I either read or heard an interview with you talking about this Soviet fear that we were about to attack them, and Bob Casey going to Reagan and Reagan kind of backing off a bit in a way that I think most of us would consider pretty darn sensible. But these other crazies were still cheerleading for heightening the tensions, weren't they?
Oh, no question. You know, the neocons of their day, I don't think we called them that. That was a term that gained currency only in the last 10 years or so during the George W. Bush administration. But the neocons of their day, people like Elliot Abrams, the Assistant Secretary of State for Latin American Affairs, clearly were part of this neoconservative contingent that wanted to increase pressure against the Soviet Union. And what may or may not have been known by a lot of these people is that in Soviet military doctrine, one of the, and this was classified journals for the most part, but well known to the intelligence community and the policy community, the Soviets always feared that one of the ways the United States would go to war against the Soviet Union would be under the cover of what appeared to be a military exercise that would actually turn into a full-blown attack that could even include nuclear weapons. And one of the exercises that the United States and NATO conducted regularly, which was called Able Archer, was an exercise that involved notional use of nuclear weapons. And in 1983, and I think this was unprecedented, high-level participation in the Able Archer exercise was going to include the President and the Secretary of Defense and the Secretary of State, and this had never been done before while I was at the Central Intelligence Agency. So you had the combination of the Able Archer exercise, the violations of Soviet airspace, the violation in the Black Sea, particularly of Soviet territorial waters, and assessments by the KGB, which at the time was led by Andropov, who eventually became General Secretary of the Soviet Union, that there was a good possibility that the United States was going to go to war against the Soviet Union. And it took the efforts of several of us to convince Bill Casey that these warnings were genuine, that the Soviets were actually fearful of such an act by the United States, whereas his deputy, Bob Gates, said there's no way that the Soviets could actually believe this. But we actually convinced Casey, which was one of the only times when I was at the CIA, I left in 1986 to go to the War College, that he took the advice of his Soviet analysts rather than the advice of his deputy, who was sort of a windsock for Bill Casey anyway, and I'm talking about Robert Gates. He took this message to the White House, and Ronald Reagan was actually shocked to learn that the Soviet Union could even consider that the United States would go to war against the Soviet Union. But he ended all high-level participation with Able Archer with that exercise. They did not; those high-level people did not take part, and the exercises were toned down. And, of course, this led the way to the beginning of arms control negotiations and the meeting in Reykjavik, Iceland, in 1986 that eventually led to the Intermediate Nuclear Force Agreement in 1987, which did away with the whole class of nuclear weapons, tactical nuclear weapons in Europe, in the European theater. So Reagan's learning about the war scare had a lot to do with convincing him that he had to change his tactics, at least, and made him a more receptive listener to what a new Soviet Secretary General in the form of Mikhail Gorbachev, who wanted arms control, deeply desired arms control. And Ronald Reagan was always a believer in the danger of nuclear weapons. I mean, that was a fundamental premise in his own national security beliefs. In fact, a lot of his allies, including Margaret Thatcher in the United Kingdom, thought he went too far in the talks on nuclear disarmament because the British wanted to protect their own nuclear forces and didn't want total disarmament. So this was a very important turning point in Soviet-American relations and in Ronald Reagan's presidency, because if you look at the first term of Ronald Reagan, excessive militarism, right-wing, denouncing the Soviet Union as the evil empire, speaking into a live microphone about, it's time to begin the nuclear war, which he thought was a rather amusing thing to be saying at the time. And then you look at the second term of Ronald Reagan, and you have all of these meetings at a high level between Soviet and American leaders, and you have a very intense pace on arms control negotiations. So there's still a lot to be written to explain this very important period in Soviet-American relations.
And my sense, as a layman, of course, but of Reykjavik is as good as it was for, particularly for a conservative Republican to do what he did, it could have been so much better, but for clinging to the idea of Star Wars, which was kind of nuts as far as I'm concerned, and was in some of his own circle trying to undermine going too far with this.
Well, there were two problems, really. Star Wars was one of the problems, and here there was a lot of misinformation about what the so-called Strategic Defense Initiative could do and how far the Soviet Union had gone with their own strategic measures. And here Robert Gates, the Deputy Director for Intelligence and eventually the Deputy Director of the CIA, engaged in a lot of misinformation about Soviet programs and clearly misinformed the White House and the American people in speeches that he gave about Soviet progress in this field. And there was a lot of misinformation about what an American national missile defense could really do. I wrote a book about this in the 1990s called The Phantom Defense. And the fact of the matter is we have never solved the problem of national missile defense. No system has ever been able to tell the difference between a decoy and a genuine missile. And without that capability, a national missile defense is worthless. But Ronald Reagan did have a belief in this and held on to it. And it just frustrated Mikhail Gorbachev because he knew the Soviet Union couldn't build such a thing. And he knew he could counter anything the United States did with a very limited increase in offensive weaponry. But he knew this was an obstacle to arms control. But there was another problem, and that was Reagan's belief that you could go to a zero level in nuclear weapons. And frankly, I feel that that will never happen because with the lack of trust between the various powers, very limited cheating in a zero environment of nuclear weapons would be a risk that neither Washington nor Moscow would be willing to take on. But that's really another issue. The fact of the matter is Star Wars was extremely oversold. We continue to waste money on national missile defense. It's still the most expensive program in the American defense budget. Maybe the F-35 fighter aircraft has passed it. But the fact of the matter is that we now have national missile defense in California and Alaska. There are military people and some Republican right-wingers who want to put it on the East Coast as well. And this is a system that has never been proven to be efficient in any way. It's just not workable.
Well, it's a very efficient moneymaker for defense contractors.
Well, and that's where the Congress comes in, just as President President Eisenhower warned in the speech about the military-industrial complex, where he had congressional written in his own hand, but chose not to use that formulation when he gave the speech because he felt he couldn't take on the Congress as well as the military and the industrial community. But the Congress treats the defense budget as a jobs program, and that's true whether they're liberals or conservatives. And my favorite example is the liberal Democratic Senate delegation from California, Feinstein and Boxer. They're liberal on a lot of issues, but anything that helps Lockheed Martin in the state of California gets the approval of Senators Feinstein and Boxer. And this is true for Democrats and Republicans in the Senate and the House, which is why we have this bloated defense budget and are building, in many cases, too much of the wrong kinds of weapon systems to begin with.
Yeah, and we could probably, you know, do a couple of shows on your book. I think I did one with one of your colleagues at CIP and with Kansas City Nuclear Weapons Production Connection. But
that was probably William Hartung.
Right, right.
But in my book, National Insecurity, The Cost of American Militarism, I get into a whole range of issues that cut across all of the services, Army, Navy, Air Force, Marine Corps, talk about the waste and the bloated nature of defense spending and the kinds of weapon systems that have no utility whatsoever and the kinds of wars that we're fighting. And one of the reasons why we lack the funds that we need for domestic issues, again, just as President Eisenhower warned, is because of too much spending in the defense area.
And we, I think we all know about the military-industrial complex, and many of us know about the congressional part that got scratched out. You got that firsthand from the president's brother, didn't you?
Exactly. I was at Hopkins as an undergraduate from 1958 to 1962. In those the years from 58 to 60, Milton Eisenhower was the president of Johns Hopkins, and he was the confidential advisor to his brother in the White House. His visits to the White House were never announced, and he was instrumental in getting a Hopkins political science professor by the name of Malcolm Moose to write the first draft of the military-industrial complex speech, the farewell speech from January 1961. And exactly. Milton asked his brother why he left out Congress, and the response was, well, it was enough to take on the military and the Congress, the military and industry. I couldn't take on the Congress, too, but that was the real problem that existed. And we see this today more than ever at the Congress when you have people such as Senator John McCain, who's now the chairman of the Senate Armed Forces Committee. He's never met or encountered a weapon system that he didn't like, that he didn't give full approval to. And even though he admitted to having sticker shock, and those were his words, sticker shock, in looking at the F-35 budget, which is totally out of control, nevertheless, not only have they approved the F-35 for the Air Force, but all sorts of expensive variants are being built for the Marine Corps, for the Navy. And it raises the question, if we have an Air Force that in part is designed to support the services, then why in the world do we need the Navy to have its own Air Force, and particularly the Marine Corps to have an Air Force that would have an F-35 with vertical takeoff and landing capabilities, when the last time the Marine Corps ever mounted an amphibious attack was in 1951 in Korea? I mean, there's nothing more dangerous than amphibious warfare. We learned this from certainly World War II, from North Africa and from Normandy, and that's why the Marines have never done it again since Korea. But yet they're getting an F-35 with its vertical capability that's designed primarily to help in amphibious warfare. So this is just one of the many outrages that we see in defense planning that never gets challenged. And John McCain, who has a background in the military, of course, probably knows this better than anybody. But you never hear any criticism, any dissent, any contrarian viewpoints from McCain or his minions on the Hill.
Yeah. Well, don't get me started on him, but you're right.
As
this is
that could be another topic or two.
Yeah.
And as you say, it is a lot of bipartisanship there, but...
Unfortunately.
This is Tom Clammer, and we've been talking to Mel Goodman, former State Department and CIA intelligence analyst, currently senior fellow at the Center for International Policy in Washington, D.C., and author most recently of National Insecurity, The Cost of American Militarism, and of the soon-to-be-released The Path to Dissent, A Whistleblower at the CIA. Let's get back to it right now.
If I'm not hopping us over all over the map too much, I would like to go back to Robert White for a bit, hear about your work with him subsequent to El Salvador. But also, you know, this all started for me a couple of weeks ago with a hearing about this delegation marking 35 years on since the murders of the four church women. Why is it important for us to understand and remember that now, do you think?
Well, I think in order to understand the issue of immigration, and we're going to hear a lot about this in this campaign, unfortunately, because you have, well, the racism and the demagoguery of people such as Donald Trump and Ted Cruz about immigration, people need to understand the responsibility of the United States for immigration from Central America. You know, when you look at the violence in Central America and the instability in Central America and these right-wing political and military organizations, these were organizations and policies that were supported by the Reagan administration and by the Central Intelligence Agency. So when you have people essentially fleeing to the United States from places such as Honduras and Nicaragua, El Salvador, they were fleeing the violence that the United States, in part, was responsible for. And when you think about Iran-Contra, for which Ronald Reagan could have been impeached if we were willing to move in that direction in the early 1980s, but after the Nixon experience, there was no real desire to do so. You have to realize that Iran-Contra was part of these militaristic policies that were designed to destabilize Central America, keep these governments weak, to allow for a great deal of American influence. So I think we have to understand what happened in El Salvador and Ambassador White's courage from that standpoint, but also just from the standpoint of an ambassador who is the president's representative, who was acting with such incredible courage and integrity in trying to defend the long-term strategic interests of the United States and not being intimidated by the neoconservatives who dominated the Reagan administration. So it's a very important personal story in understanding Bob White's role, but it's also an important policy story in understanding mistakes that the United States has made over the years in relying on the military, relying on militarism. And when you fast forward to the current situation, and particularly when you look at the Middle East in terms of militarism, before we invaded Iraq in 2003, look at all of the stable governments that existed. Maybe they weren't governments we approved of, and they were led by some very difficult personalities who we did not favor, but there was stability in those places. In Libya, in Egypt, in Iraq, in Syria to a certain extent. Then you use military force in Iraq with over 100,000, 150,000 troops being introduced. And now you have this incredible instability throughout the Middle East. And now with this latest wave of tension and violence between Saudi Arabia and Iran, it's unpredictable in terms of what could happen as this whole region plummets because of a series of dysfunctional governments and the sectarian and religious strife that exists within all these countries. So it's important to understand what role we played with the overuse of military power in creating these dysfunctional situations. And that's exactly what Bob White was exactly what he was taking on to make sure we didn't end up on the wrong side of history, which is what we did in Vietnam. He was a very young Foreign Service officer at that time and not in a position of influence, but he knew all the mistakes that were made in the 1960s and 70s by Lyndon Johnson and Richard Nixon and Henry Kissinger. And I think when he was in a position to have a certain amount of influence and a certain amount of leverage, he used that to move U.S. policy back toward a saner direction. You know, even before El Salvador, he took on Henry Kissinger. And Henry Kissinger kept Bob White from becoming the possible ambassador to Cuba if relations were ever restored. Kissinger tried to limit Bob White's career in the 1970s. And there were people who were surprised when Bob White was named the ambassador to El Salvador because they knew his background. He had been in Paraguay where there was a dictator, Stroessner, who he took on successfully, I might add. And they knew that in El Salvador he wouldn't tolerate the abuses that existed in that country. And Jesse Helms, Senator Jesse Helms, who was the leading troglodyte of his day in the 1980s and early 1990s, knew that sending Bob White to El Salvador was going to lead to problems for the Reagan administration. And, of course, he was right about that.
And I would hope that even most apologists for these kinds of policies would stop short of being okay with the rape and murder of these church women, as Jean Kirkpatrick and Al Haig seem to be. But the story then was still the domino theory, was it not? We've got to stop communism, greater good, and all of this stuff. How much of that could wash with a reasonable person, do you think?
Well, I think if someone were willing to step back and try to be objective about the international community and saw the incredible power of the United States and influence of the United States in terms of military, political, economic power during the Cold War, they would have to realize that that events that took place in Central America and South America, or Southeast Asia for that matter, were just not threatening to the stability of the United States or the economy of the United States. Yet we took on all of these issues, and now we have, as a result, 800 to 900 overseas military facilities, bases, facilities, operating points. Yet several weeks ago in the New York Times, a big deal was made about the fact that China, for the first time in its history, is going to have an overseas facility on the Horn of Africa in Djibouti. It's not a base, it's just a operating facility where their ships can refuel and replenish. We make a big deal about the one Russian naval facility outside of Russia itself. It happens to be in Syria, which of course is a sensitive area, but you can't tell me that that's any match or any threat to all of the military facilities that the United States has in every Persian Gulf country, with the obvious exception of Iran. So we built this huge military arsenal and this military overseas fortress, these hundreds of facilities at tremendous expense, yet we still worry about the stability of the United States. You know, even looking at terrorism, we greatly exaggerate the threat that terrorism represents in terms of United States influence or United States power. And this is something that Bob White genuinely understood. Bob White knew that the reason why diplomacy was so important and why the role of the State Department was so important was that negotiated solutions should be applied to conflict, that you had to have a moral component in dealing with regimes and dealing with the will of local populations. You just can't run over the interests of these people without paying a certain price. And again, to go back to the invasion of Iraq in 2003 on the false notion that Iraq had weapons of mass destruction and that Saddam Hussein had ties to Al-Qaeda and Saddam Hussein had ties to 9/11, all of the lies of Vice President Dick Cheney and the Bush administration have really put the United States in a very difficult situation, because here we are now in the Middle East, where we have no influence whatsoever, no leverage whatsoever, nothing we can do about all of the dysfunctional governments that dominate that region. Yet at the same time, I hear time and time again from people who should know better saying, but we can't pull out. And, of course, my argument has always been, well, why can't we? What difference would it make if we cut back on our visibility, on our level of influence and our presence in the Middle East? Because everyone recognizes there's really very little we can do about Syria. Syria will never be put back together again. I don't think Iraq will ever be put back together again. And from an historical standpoint, we're in the situation that Lawrence of Arabia warned about 100 years ago when he looked at the colonial maps that were used to form these phony borders and said, this will not stand. Well, maybe it took him a century to be accurate, but here we are now. The borders no longer control the geographic or political fortunes of these regions, and there is nothing that we can do about that.
Yeah. And you mentioned Libya. I can't help bringing up this political opportunist obsession on the right with Benghazi. And as you've written, they've asked former Secretary Hillary Clinton all the wrong questions in this witch hunt for her. And there's important issues that they're just totally ignoring.
Well, the point I made is that what we learned about Benghazi from those hearings was really not relevant, and what was relevant was never even discussed. But in the process, they made Hillary Clinton, frankly, look very capable and very competent. I mean, that was a hearing that the Republicans totally mishandled, and they even understand that now. But really what needs to be discussed about Libya is why in the world we were engaging in an exercise in regime change, the very thing that Bob White warned about in the 1970s and 1980s, the idea of violent regime change. And frankly, to be fair to Vladimir Putin, this is something that has stuck in his craw. The United States engaging in regime change in Afghanistan, in Iraq, in Syria, in Libya, and saying, in the case of Syria, that this is not going to happen once again. And regime change, when you look at it historically, and it really started under the Eisenhower administration with Iran in 1953, all of these exercises in CIA covert action and coup d'etat and regime change have strategically failed. I can't think of one example that enhanced American security, whether it was Iran in 53 or the targeting of Diem in Vietnam in 1963 by Kennedy, or what Kissinger and Nixon did in Chile in the early 1970s. The overthrow of Gaddafi more recently in Libya. Libya now is virtually does not exist. It's just a tribal area, the East versus West, and now in the center you have a group that has allegiance to ISIS. It's one more point where ISIS has some political and military influence. So regime change has been a disaster for the interests of the United States. But this is something that neoconservatives have called for despite all of the examples of failure.
As we're starting to wind down, there's some time left. I wonder if I could bring it back a little more to Ambassador White and what kind of work he was doing at this Center for International Policy that you're still with now. What was he trying to accomplish there?
Well, at the center, he was supporting my work, which was trying to engage in reforming the intelligence community. And we started this work long before the abuses of the CIA in the war on terror, long before what we learned about secret prisons and torture and abuse and extraordinary renditions. That was very important work to him because he knew that the CIA had gained far too much influence in national security decision-making in Washington. But he also was playing a very important role in getting the United States back to playing a major role in international organization, to put the United States back on the high moral ground. And here part of it was dictated by the thinking of Woodrow Wilson and the League of Nations and collective security after World War I, but the role of the United Nations after World War II. And he was very concerned about the presidency of Bill Clinton, and I don't think this is properly understood, you know, how much harm that was done to American national security by Bill Clinton, by the enlargement of the North Atlantic Treaty Organization, which was totally uncalled for once the Soviet Union collapsed in 1991, by denying a role for the United States in the International Criminal Court, which would be so important to today's situation when people are talking about the war crimes of the Islamic State, which ultimately should come before the International Criminal Court, where the United States plays no role whatsoever. The various work of international organizations in banning cluster bombs, which the Clinton administration did not support. Bob White was in favor of bureaucratic reform. He was opposed to abolishing the Arms Control and Disarmament Agency, which Bill Clinton did in the 1990s, bowing to the pressure of people like Jesse Helms in the Senate and Newt Gingrich in the House. And he wasn't, Bob wasn't a propagandist. He did his work quietly. He lobbied on the Hill. He had a good relationship with then-Senator John Kerry. He was a highly respected figure. He did a lot of work testifying in various cases over deportation proceedings to make sure that the people were, who were involved in El Salvador and all sorts of crimes against humanity were not allowed to live peacefully in the United States, to make sure they were sent back to El Salvador, and he had some important successes in this regard. So in terms of getting the United States on the right side of history, and in trying to restore the moral compass of the United States and put us on more of a moral high ground in our negotiations with other major powers, Bob White was just a voice for reason. And he was a quiet, effective voice. He wasn't a polemicist. I went on a couple speaking tours with him, and he was incredibly effective in talking to large audiences about these issues and educating people about the importance of United States' role that was based on human rights and international negotiation and resolving international conflict. And frankly, when I look now, and it's going to be this way for all of 2016 until this election takes place, the dialogue, I think, is going to be an embarrassment to many of us, because it's all going to be about who can appear to be the toughest cat on the block in dealing with international situations, even though we learn time and time again, as Bob White told us, that this overuse of military force just does not work. It is not effective.
What was he like as a person? Can you describe him a little bit more?
He was just a wonderful man with a great sense of humor. My wife and I had dinner with him quite often, and until his wife got sick, because Marianne had to deal with Alzheimer's for the last 5 or 6 years of her life. They were an engaging couple. They were both widely read. They loved cinema. They loved theater. They loved to read and discuss books. Bob White was quite witty. He's a great storyteller. I just adored the guy. I think one of the my favorite experiences in my 42 years with the government was getting to know Bob White and getting to have dinner with Bob White and getting to just learn from Bob White, from his experiences and from his thoughtfulness. It was an important thing in my own professional career, which was at a much more modest level than his. But I learned so much from him and dependent on him so much, and I miss him so much because there's so many things that are happening now where my first thought was, I'd love to know what Bob White thinks about this situation. I'd love to be able to talk to Bob now about what in the world is happening between Sunni and Shia in the Middle East and the Persian Gulf, how far the tension between Saudi Arabia and Iran can go, what it means for the interests of the United States. And, you know, Bob was just one of just a handful of people who had a sane approach to these very difficult problems.
Let me go out, kind of shift gears a little bit with a question about media. Now, I mean, just the fact that I remember the headlines when these four church women were murdered in 1980 says that this was pretty big news because I wasn't particularly politically engaged or paying much attention back then. But I don't know what kind of context was given to the typical news consumer. And Ray McGovern, your former colleague, has talked about one of the biggest things he's observed in 50-plus years in Washington is how effectively a functioning free press has disappeared in terms of informing the public about important issues. What are your thoughts on that in terms of what we've been discussing?
Well, in broader terms of this discussion, my real concern is the dumbing down that's taking place in this country about international affairs. And in discussing the dumbing down aspect of the American populace, I point to the media's role in this process. There's been a great reduction of foreign news coverage. Foreign bureaus, for the most part, have been closed up by a lot of major newspapers. The Baltimore Sun is a perfectly good example of this. Once a very good newspaper with foreign bureaus all over the world, and very few foreign bureaus now. Even my own hometown paper, the Washington Post, devotes very little attention to international affairs. It's extremely sparse. And what really worries me, that if you read the newspaper closely, as I do, I read the New York Times, the Washington Post, the Wall Street Journal every day, most of what you read in all three of those newspapers, even the New York Times, is information that's been put in the paper one way or another by official sources, by government sources, by authoritative sources. You have very little contrarian viewpoints. Very few dissidents are able to get their opinions into the major instruments of the national press community. And then when you look at televised news, well, that's the great wasteland that someone labeled it many decades ago, and it's getting worse. I'm convinced that CNN is, its only priority is scaring the hell out of the American people about terrorism. So this is what worries me, because I think, and I go around the country, I lecture at universities all over the country, I talk to a lot of veterans groups. I'm going down to Sarasota next month to talk to the Vets for Peace there. I've been out to Bellingham, Washington. I'm going to San Francisco in April. I think there's a real hunger for a genuine discussion of context, and I think you used that word earlier, and that's what's missing from the press. Even the New York Times, which I grew up on the Times, is the paper of record. It's no longer the paper of record. They don't repeat speeches that are given anymore the way they used to. They don't provide the kind of context to a news story that's needed. And the New York Times, to me, is still the only serious paper that we have in this country of over 300 million people, which is an embarrassment in itself. So what has happened to the news business, what has happened to professional journalism, is extremely sad. But I must add another element to this, though, because the writing that comes out of the academic community is extremely unimpressive in a lot of national security areas. So I don't know what professors are using academic freedom for, but they're not using it to present controversial thinking on very important issues, and that concerns me.
Well, Mel Goodman, time has wound down. We've got maybe half a minute for any quick final thoughts you have, but we're about out here.
Well, I want to thank you for allowing a discussion that ranged widely over a lot of issues that were important to Ambassador Robert White. And just to remind people that he was with the Center for International Policy for his last 10, 15 years of his professional life, and that they can go to the website of the Center for International Policy, which is CIPonline.org, and the writings of senior fellows such as myself are on that website, along with some of the work that Robert White has done, and hopefully one day, and sadly it'll have to be posthumously, but his memoir will, I think, eventually appear. I know that his daughter, Claire, is working very hard on this, and that there are people working on the project. It'll be a very important work, and I think it'll be a work that I hope that you can discuss in one of your news hours.
Well, I told her I want her back when the book is out, and so we've got that penciled in at some unknown date. looking forward to that, and I'm not sure why I've waited so long to have you on again, but I'm not going to wait so long next time.
Thank you, Tom. It's good to be with you.
Thank you.
Well, that's it. We're out of time. You've been listening to the podcast edition of Tell Somebody, www.tellsomebody.us. Comments or questions, send an email to mail@tellsomebody.us. You can also follow me on Twitter, @tellsomebodynow, and like the Facebook page, facebook.com/tellsomebodynow. This Tell Somebody podcast is produced and distributed by Tell Somebody and may or may not reflect the broadcast of Tell Somebody, heard on 90.1 FM KKFI in Kansas City, streaming around the world at www.kkfi.org. I'll be on 90.1 FM KKFI every Thursday morning at 9 Central Time, right after Democracy Now! If you haven't heard Tell Somebody before, I hope you will listen again. Check out the podcast and the broadcast. Click on a tile at tellsomebody.us for a link to a past show. If you enjoyed the show and appreciated the information you got from it, please tell somebody about the podcast and the broadcast.